Wow. Wednesday, 5 p.m., time for American Hit Radio on 90.3 WHPC.
You made it.
We did make it. And I'm noticed that you did too, like, because you're tuning in and listening. So thank you so much for being with us, just like Mary Tyler Moore. Gonna make it after all. We are gonna do something for the next few weeks that's gonna make you think that Wednesdays are Fridays if you're a regular listener to our program on both days. As you may know, on Fridays we do a thing called How Music Changed. And what we do there is we just grab us an idea for a series of shows that covers what we consider to be the most important parts of musical history. And when you put them all together, you should get a really good overview of what's happened from the beginning of recorded history until the present. That's the Friday show. So, like, for example, right now we're doing the Great American Songbook. We've done 18 shows on that. And we'll do that until we finish that up. And then we'll move on to something much more contemporary, which is to say from like the mid-60s up till maybe the 70s at this point in time. Then we'll go back in time again. So what we've been doing here on Wednesdays, of course, is playing our way through albums from 1964 up until 1973. And what that usually means is that we'd play, like, for example, as we did last week, we played Fresh by Sly and the Family Stone in its entirety. Before that, we played There Goes Rhymin' Simon by Paul Simon in its entirety. Before that, we played a Bob Marley album in its entirety. Well, now, in June of 1973, is a point that I'm making an exception to what the list is, because the list up until this point was always about artists putting out a new album release of original, well, of new material. Greatest hits are verboten on the list. I really don't want to have any greatest hits. And collections, for the most part, are not allowed on the list either. I make an exception here for this record that came out in June of 1973. Such an exception that I'm probably going to be doing this, like I said, it's probably going to take 6 weeks to cover it. Why? Well, in 1973, this album rocked my world and opened me up to an entirely new perspective toward music. The record we're going to be covering is called The Smithsonian Collection of Classic Jazz. Now, don't freak out if you're a pop fan or if you come in here to tune in and hear some rock and roll. And I'll tell you why. Before I bought this album collection, I considered music as something contemporary, meaning that it had a shelf life. The music industry itself promoted that type of thinking, releasing ever new product to spark interest and, of course, generate a steady income stream. This suited the record labels, the radio stations, and also the industry hacks whose business was to always discover the, quote, next big thing. Nobody wanted yesterday's papers. So from the inception of recorded sound, old music was pushed aside for newer product. Of course, this isn't a bad thing in and of itself. Nothing in this world stays the same, and perhaps more than anything else, music does an incredible job of reflecting its times, allowing every generation to have its own unique sound and identity. But for a long while, most of us never looked back. The trends of the 20s were virtually forgotten in the 30s. The music fans of the 40s also neglected the decades that preceded them. By the time rock and roll came along in the mid-50s, everything that came before was trampled by the immediacy of the new music form. Music was a form of fashion, with old styles being stored away or discarded. But what about our history? America in the 20th century had, or rather still has, a music culture so complex and rich with discovery that it boggles the mind. Before then, a music culture from Europe and the classical form determined musical development. But at the dawn of the recording age, virtually every single musical development in the Western world happened right here in the United States. Each generation kept moving forward, barely ever looking back, and so much history could have been lost. The Smithsonian Collection of Classic Jazz compiles some of the most important music from the first existence of recorded evidence until mid-20th century, when this album was first released, and it has been released a few times over the years. The album was available through mail order only, so buying it took a certain degree of deliberation and genuine curiosity. It may have been the very first time that I found myself looking back at quote-unquote old music, as if thumbing through old black and white photographs, and I grew totally fascinated by what I didn't know. Before this purchase, Bessie Smith was a cartoon character in my world. Louis Armstrong was a real-life character who smiled incessantly and sang Hello, Dolly, and also a cartoon character. Benny Goodman was someone my parents used to talk about, but ultimately abandoned for smooth vocalists like Jerry Vale and Charlie Parker, was little more than a name I'd heard. Imagine the sense of discovery to hear this history unfold over six albums. I played this collection incessantly, absorbing every track as if it was gospel, which, in a sense, it was, is. Louis Armstrong gave me goosebumps, my spirit floating somewhere between the absolute joy in his performance and the deep melancholy of immersing myself so deeply in the culture of our past. As a kid, I would confuse Duke Ellington and Count Basie, but this collection made their disparate styles crystal clear to me. Names like Thelonious Monk, Charles Mingus, and Sonny Rollins came into focus as if in a Technicolor film. How could we have let this go? Why was I not informed of this? At a time when record labels were offering me to choose between ELP or ELO, all this history was languishing. It could not have been an overstatement to say that the Smithsonian collection of classic jazz changed my life. I no longer saw music as something solely of its time, and it stimulated a lifetime pursuit of discovering as much history as my brain could possibly absorb or as time would allow. And anybody who knows me on this show knows that, at least that much about me, to be true. There is so much out there that one lifetime will not suffice. But that only makes me hungrier for more as I dig deep into our past for discoveries that enrich my life and help me understand how we got to where we are in the first place. This and another collection called The Anthology of American Folk Music are surely the most vital albums of my entire collection. They provide perspective while teaching me to appreciate the roots that spawned all that followed. Good music never gets old. I say that all the time. Great music remains as vital and contemporary as today's headlines. If you have any desire whatsoever to understand American music history of the 20th century, I can think of no better place to start than with this collection. So let's dive in. The coolest thing that they start with is a song that actually just barely makes it into the recorded music history. It was a piano roll made by Scott Joplin. This is a track called The Maple Leaf Rag. And in 1986, somebody took Scott Joplin's piano roll and recorded it for posterity. It was what he would do. Now, at the time, how he would play it. The thing about it is that, keep this in mind, a player piano that is triggered by the roll, a mechanical roll that goes by and forces the keys to be struck, is a mechanical item. It's not really an instrument. It has no dynamics. It can't get louder and softer. Really, very little shading, no real sense of dynamics even. Every note that is struck mechanically with the exact same pressure as any other note. So the embellishments are gone. The effects are gone. Spontaneity isn't really there either. The only way you might get some of that is when the person was actually printing up the roll, that he might have added a couple of extra keys that would have been physically impossible for the original person to play in the first place. Maple Leaf Rag is, of course, ragtime being more or less the thing that was happening just as recorded music was beginning to develop. And it is the thing that fed jazz. So we're going to start with Scott Joplin, the piano roll version of him performing his own song. But to show how it began to change into something that is more like a jazz feel, we're then going to play the exact same song, but this time featuring Jelly Roll Morton. playing the song, who was a New Orleans piano player who knew all about New Orleans band arrangements. And it was his idea that a good piano player, if he was good at what he did, would basically follow the styles of what a band would do, a five or six piece band. So as he plays the song, you might hear the trumpet and clarinet part with his right hand, and you'll hear like the trombone and the rhythm part in his left hand. So just in these two tracks, by the way, I should mention that Jelly Roll Morton's track was recorded in 1938. So it was not a contemporary from 1925, but it's him showing what he was doing at the time. And you'll get a really good feel for how quickly jazz developed from the ragtime to what the Jelly Roll Morton feel. So back to back, two versions of Maple Leaf Rag.
Thank you.
All right, back-to-back versions of the Maple Leaf Rag. Now, you notice the first one, which was the piano roll, as performed by Scott Joplin. There are syncopations were quite obvious, and that was it was the syncopations that made it cool and different. But with Jelly Roll Morton, two things change right away. The first is you get that jazz triplet feel bounce that makes it swing a lot more than the original piano roll. The other thing is what Jelly Roll himself would have called the Spanish thing, where he would play like a dun 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 dun, and that became sort of like this backbone to where the jazz players were beginning to get a feel behind arrangements so that players could play together and improvise and more or less know where they were without sounding like they were basically pounding four on the floor. Really, really important development in jazz right there. Now, this collection is not strictly chronological, although it is more or less chronological. You notice it most in the beginning because, like I said, that was Jelly Roll Morton recording that song in 1938. It wouldn't have made sense to put it in 1938, though. You've got to hear it in context with the birth of jazz, because that's what Jelly Roll Morton, when he was famous, when he was doing what he was doing. The same thing for these next tracks. Before we get strictly into how jazz itself developed, you really ought to at least have an introduction to how influential the blues were on the development of jazz. And these two tracks, both by Bessie Smith, are fabulous examples of just that. Yes, Bessie Smith was a stunning, powerful, overwhelming interpretive blues singer. But here on this first track that she performs, it's written by W.C. Handy, who called himself the father of the blues. It's one of his most famous songs called St. Louis Blues, which most people now see as a jazz classic. And the other factor about this track itself is you've got Fred Longshaw playing reed organ in the background, but much more interesting is the cornet player. It's Louis Armstrong playing with Bessie Smith. And this is recorded back in January of 1925. Now, Bessie Smith was not in love with Louis Armstrong when they played together because his tone was so rich and so strong that she felt that it was overwhelming her.
Right.
These are the days when recordings were done acoustically.
Right.
So it would be very easy for a powerful instrument to overwhelm a vocalist. So when she came back into the studio about maybe a year and a half later to record a song called Lost Your Head Blues, she made sure that she brought in a different cornet player named Joe Smith. And Fletcher Henderson, a very young Fletcher Henderson, played piano for her on that track. Story goes that on Lost Your Head Blues, she more or less was improvising it. She had time left in a recording session, and with these players, she more or less just improvised on a blues, and it is now considered one of the most classic recordings that she'd ever made. So, again, back-to-back now, two Bessie Smith tracks, starting with W.C. Handy's St. Louis Blues. We'll segue that into Lost Your Head Blues with music and lyrics by Bessie Smith herself.
I hate to see the evening sun go down.
Jesse Blues, Jesse, what's that to me?
Lost Your Head?
Bessie Smith, singing two blues numbers there, St. Louis Blues and Lost Your Head Blues, but with a distinctive jazz flavor to it. And now we can more or less say that we're going to basically follow chronology. The next song is the oldest song in this entire box set. Also one of the most interesting. It was recorded on April 6th, 1923 by King Oliver's Creole Jazz Band. You're gonna know it's old because I'm telling you now, the sound of the recording is awful. It's just was not easy to get a good recording in 1923. It might even be bad by 1923 standards, to be honest. But the players in King Oliver's Creole Jazz Band on this track, other than King Oliver himself, is Louis Armstrong on cornet as his protege, Honoré Dutry on trombone, Johnny Dodds on clarinet, Lil Hardin, the future Mrs. Armstrong, on piano, Bill Johnson on banjo and takes a vocal break, Baby Dodds on drums, and these are the same people that would eventually team up and become part of Louis Armstrong's own band. So the players are pretty incredible. What you're going to hear now, since we heard the blues with Bessie Smith, is sort of a jazz blues. These guys, this is like what ensemble playing was like, early jazz. Everybody would more or less play at the same time, stepping back to allow somebody to take a solo here and there. You will definitely hear Johnny Dodds take a couple of rounds on clarinet and then King Oliver take a few on his own trumpet. But there are sections in the middle where they all seem to be soloing at the same time. And it's sort of like a jazz blues. And these guys knew each other so well that they probably could have been playing in different rooms and they would have played together perfectly because they just had that sort of a relationship. So we're going to play that track first, King Oliver's Creole Jazz Band version of Dippermouth Blues. But then we're going to bring Jelly Roll Morton back. This song was recorded 12 years before he recorded that version that we played of Maple Leaf Rag. This is a song that he recorded that back in September of 1926, a little bit more than 3 years after the King Oliver track Dippermouth Blues. What you're going to hear now on this is the difference. Note the arrangement. Note what Jelly Roll Morton brings to the composition. He wrote the song, and he's not so much interested in having all the players play as an ensemble solo, blowing their way through the song. The arrangement breaks things down. There's pauses. There's instrumental shifts. It's obviously a well-constructed, written-out composition. And you'll also hear a little bit of the rhythm of the song. It's called Black Bottom Stomp. It was kind of based on the whole Charleston inspiration thing, which is to say the Spanish thing that I was talking about earlier with Jelly Roll Morton. If you think of that Charleston rhythm, that dun, 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 that's the Spanish thing.
That's the thing. Charleston.
That's the Charleston, and that's also the Spanish thing. So we're starting with King Oliver's Creole Jazz Band, Dippermouth Blues from 1923. I'm going to segue into Jelly Roll Morton's Red Hot Peppers' Black Bottom Stomp from 1926. Thank you. Comparing those two tracks is like mind-boggling to me, because you have King Creole's King Oliver's Creole Jazz Band, excuse me, basically doing the polyphony thing where everybody is kind of jamming together and moving through the changes with an instinctive sense, and then you've got Black Bottom Stomp by Jelly Roll Morton with the band pretty much following an amazingly tight, intricate arrangement with stops and starts, and they knew exactly where they were at every second, at every turn. We're going to stick with Jelly Roll Morton for two more, because this is the way that they appear on the Smithsonian Collection of Classic Jazz, and I'm not going to change a bit, because I put so much, I have so much love for this box set, the way that it's organized and everything else. So the next two tracks, again, by Jelly Roll Morton's Red Hot Peppers, pretty much the same band. Actually, this next track recorded just 6 days after Black Bottom Stomp. The band is, if I didn't mention it before, Jelly Roll Morton, of course, on piano, George Mitchell on trombone, Kid Ory also on trombone, with Barney Bigard, who a lot of people might eventually recognize because he was a big, an important member of Duke Ellington's band in about 10 years' time. Darnell Howard and Omer Simeon, all on clarinet. Johnny Sancier on banjo. John Lindsay on bass. And then the drummer named Andrew Hilaire. Now, in this instance, the song is called Dead Man's Blues. And almost to set it up with a sense of tongue-in-cheek irony, it opens with Chopin's Funeral March. Note right away the New Orleans polyphony sound that almost sounds like they're going back to the same thing that King Oliver was doing at their time. But the arrangement of the song suggests Scott Joplin's songwriting style, in the sense that there are like four distinct sections that are sequenced in a certain way. So it's not playing through a typical blues changes, because the chords change with each section and the way that the melody changes. And then eventually it all resolves back to where it began, right after that Funeral March opening. We'll follow that track with a song called Grandpa's Spells. Three, again, with multiple sections, three sections. This time, it's basically taking ragtime and putting it through the ringer. It was a piece that Jelly Roll Morton wrote as for piano only, but he rearranged it for eight instruments. And again, it's going to be the arrangement that basically makes this thing pop and hopefully gets you to maybe appreciate why Jelly Roll Morton is such a big deal even to this very day. So back to back, we start with Dead Man's Blues and we will follow that with Grandpa's Spells.
What did I hear at 12 o'clock in the daytime? Church bell ringing.
Man, you don't hear no church bell ringing at 12 o'clock in the day.
Yes, indeed. Somebody must be dead.
Ain't nobody dead. Somebody must be dead drunk.
No, I think it's a funeral.
Hey, look here. I believe it is a funeral. I believe I hear that trombone phone.
Thank you.
in about 6 minutes, you get a full picture of the genius of Jelly Roll Morton. And we're not done yet. One more song appears on the Smithsonian Collection, and it was his biggest hit ever. What's amazing is that Jelly Roll Morton never recorded King Porter Stomp with a band. He only played it as a solo piano piece, which is really crazy when I think about it, because there are dozens of other bands that covered King Porter Stomp right up into the end of the 30s. It was one of the most popular big band songs to be played. It was ubiquitous. Now, to get a feel for it, though, since it is just a piano version, listen to how Jelly Roll Morton builds his arrangement layer upon layer as he moves through the song, and how it kind of never gets boring. It keeps shifting as a piano piece. And we're going to follow that with, oh boy, this is just so amazing, a track called Cakewalking Babies from Home. The band is called the Red Onion Jazz Babies. Now, the Red Onion was the name of a bar in New Orleans back at the time. So it was just a casual name. It wasn't anything that they planned to stick with. And Cakewalking Babies from Home is actually a reference to a style of music that was called the cakewalk, mm-hmm. that was popular before ragtime, before this box set even began. Now, the cakewalk had like a 2-4 feel, like ragtime, but a little bit of like a, there was a way you would sing with it, but it had like an old-fashioned style of singing. So you're going to hear Alberta Hunter and Clarence Todd both going back and forth on a vocal bit on this recording, which is pretty funny, because what they're basically trying to do is play off of the old-fashioned style of what was the cakewalk. They're already kind of like saying, look how far we've come. Remember when we used to sound like this? So there's a lot of humor in that. They're basically, obviously, having a lot of fun. This is, you got to hear the band. Who are the Red Onion Jazz Babies? Well, it's Louis Armstrong and Sidney Bechet, the two most famous soloists in the first 20 years of jazz. Louis Armstrong, of course, his cornet and trumpet playing changed the history of music. Sidney Bechet was doing the exact same thing on his own instruments. And with them is Lil Armstrong on piano, eventually who married Louis, Charlie Irvis on trombone, struggling. If you listen close, you'll hear him like trying to keep up with those two guys. I can imagine how hard that would be. I mentioned Alberta Hunter and Clarence Todd as the vocalists. But the thing to watch out for are the solos by Louis Armstrong and Bechet. One more point before I play the tracks. Just a week later, I believe, or something like that, there was a second version of Cakewalking Babies Back Home that was recorded by the exact same band. Only this time it was released and credited to Clarence Williams' Blue Five. If you're into it, look it up, because it's the same band with a slightly different arrangement, but doing pretty much the same thing. And they're very telling. If I had the time to play them both side by side, I would, but I'm doing what the box set tells me to do. So these will be our last two songs of the day. We'll start with Jelly Roll Morton's King Porter Stomp, and the set will end with the Red Onion Jazz Babies' Cakewalking Babies from Home. Of course, we're going to be back next week as we continue our march through the history of jazz as it is presented by the Smithsonian Collection of Classic Jazz. I hope you can sense my sense of excitement doing this, because we're going to encapsulate 50 years of the best American music maybe ever made in these next few weeks by doing this. So thanks so much for listening, and I hope you can come back and join us as we continue our way through the rest of the decade of the 20s, and then onward from there. Take care, folks.